My subject that I came to Holden to talk about is women in the visual arts. And what I want to talk about today is why I got involved in that subject and some of the ramifications of it. Last week I started out with a slide presentation based on a British Broadcasting Company television series called Ways of Seeing. And I looked at ways in which artists in the modern Western world, that is, from the early Renaissance to the present, have turned women into an object, whether they mean to or not. And when you turn a person into an object, you tend to treat them like an object. And then I talked about... Let's see, what did I do last week? I talked about an interesting woman, a biblical heroine named Susanna. And she really is a very strong person, but when you look at the way Western art has handled that subject matter, she turns into a pinup girl from a Playboy magazine. And nowhere in the history of art do you ever find that this woman was something very special. And I'm going to talk about that subject again later on, but it shows ways in which traditional Western art history has really been distorted or biased in favor of a masculine perspective. Let's see, I talked about two very interesting women painters, Mary Cassatt and Georgia O'Keeffe. And I don't think I'll talk about them this week, but I'll bring them back next week. And then the last thing I did was to talk about the quilt makers. And I'll say something about that today. And I'd like to bring those people back again, because it's just fun to look at a lot of wonderful quilts. But my main point there was to show how our definitions of what is good art, what's strong art, what's important art has changed. Traditionally, quilt making has been a very minor activity. But suddenly, I think people are talking about quilt making as a very important, very healthy, very positive kind of activity. And it does relate to human values. Well, I really do have to cling to my very sacred notebook here that I've been scribbling in all morning while watching Thor and his partner not accomplish a great deal. That's not true. I peek out the window every once in a while to see if anything's happening on the porch over there that started 2 years ago.
Come back another year.
Let's see, I forgot that we're making a tape of this, so I'm supposed to say who I am. I'm John Mockested. I teach at St. Olaf College in the art department. I have a half-time appointment in the art department in art history. I also have a half-time appointment in the Paracollege. The Paracollege is like Holden Village. If you could define it, it wouldn't exist. It's a vague, loose, amorphous kind of idea. And the dynamics of the Paracollege depend upon the students who are there at the time and what they want to do. And that's the same with this community here that changes from week to week. And you never could really put your finger on what Holden Village is all about. Some of you have been here before. It's always different. It's always a surprise. The Paracollege involves my role as a tutor, negotiating with a student to develop a variety of strategies to prepare for some senior comprehensive exams and probably projects. And these strategies may or may not involve classes, they may involve individual tutorials or seminars. The Paracollege is committed to the inclusion of third world perspectives and feminist concerns wherever appropriate or relevant in coursework. And I accepted that command from Paracollege, I think quite willingly. I don't force the issue, but all of us really do work very seriously at trying to talk about these various issues. And I was just involved in a seminar that was talking about the medieval world and we played Islam against its contemporary events in Europe at the same time, and we also looked at the Islamic treatment of women and the European medieval treatment of women, the effect of the Crusades. All these kinds of things were part of that seminar, and they all seemed very appropriate and necessary. So I don't think we are forcing anything on our curriculum. The subject today is the quality of the masculine and the feminine in art, and it would have been easier simply to say gender issues in art history. And that's basically what I want to focus on. Let's see. I'm an artist sometimes. I use that phrase with some reservation or fear. I don't think every time you pick up a pencil, you're an artist. Every time you squeeze oil paint out of a tube and put it on a canvas, you probably should have left it in the tube because it doesn't dry out quite so fast in the tube. And all you're doing is shuffling materials around. But every once in a while, it clicks, and you can say, today I was an artist. And everything I do comes from that point of view. I teach art history not as a scholar, not as a well-educated scholar. I teach it from the point of view of one who knows what it feels like to make a painting. I'm not an anthropologist, but I have to be a little bit. I'm not a sociologist, but sometimes I have to play like I am. I'm not a psychologist or a theologian, but I am a person who makes marks on canvases. I'm a human being. And I also get very upset by what I see other human beings do to other human beings. And when I became aware of the fact that artists were treating women with a certain kind of indifference, or for very personal reasons, I started to get sort of angry, quite angry. I'm embarrassed, in fact, by some of the things that have happened in my field. So I don't know if what I want to do today is to get up on a soapbox and deliver a sermon. It's partly a sermon. It's partly a lecture. But I would really like to start out with a text. And this is not just to legitimize what I'm going to talk about. But I think it's there in the back of my mind, no matter what I'm doing. From Colossians. Jesus Christ is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For in him all things were created, in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or principalities or authorities. All things were created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. He is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in everything he might be preeminent, for in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of the cross. Holden, I was excited about that text because Holden Village mailed out a reprint of a great sermon that Joseph Sittler wrote for World Council of Churches meetings in 1961 in New Delhi. And I don't know if any of you know Joseph Sittler, but he has this big booming voice, and when he reads that text, the whole heavens clash and crash and bang around, there's lightning. I mean, it's, when Joseph Sittler speaks, it's like God himself. So my little kind of whiny Midwestern Minnesota voice is a little bit of an insult. But let me say some things that's a quote from Sittler's sermon. The subject of the conference was unity, and it opened with Sittler's cosmic text. It's a text which encompasses heaven and earth, female and male, the elements, plants and animals and humans, the sun and fruit, and all creation unified by the cross. Sittler wrote, these verses sing out their triumphant and alluring music between two huge and steady poles, Christ and all things. The sweep of God's restorative action in Christ is no smaller than the sixth time repeated all things. Redemption is the name for this will. this action and this concrete man who is God with us and God for us. All things, says Sittler, are permeable to his cosmic redemption because all things subsist in him. He comes to all things not as a stranger, for he is the firstborn of all creation. He is not only the matrix of all things, that is, the glue that holds it all together, but he is the intention, the fullness, and the integrity of all things. Paul wrote to correct the Colossian error, which assumed that there were thrones, dominions, principalities, and authorities which have a life and power apart from Christ, that the real world was a dualism, one part of which, containing the power of evil, was not subject to the lordship of the Creator in Christ. All is claimed for God and is of him, in him, through him, and for him. All things claimed for God include the world political and all of the tensions therein, the world economic, the world scientific, the world aesthetic, that is, the world of art, past, present, and future. And I have to believe that. I'm part of the Protestant tradition, which threw out the visual arts. I don't think they meant for that to happen, but it happened. And so at my school, the art department is second best to the famous St. Olaf Choir, which stayed in there. But we try harder and we think we're better than the music department. I've already talked about my role at college, in the Paracollege, and my intention to include feminist and third world perspectives. And And my reason for reading Paul's letter and Sittler's comments is that I gain enthusiasm and encouragement from those kinds of texts in terms of everything that I deal with, whether it's teepees or American quilts or China decoration or skyscrapers or log cabins. It all has a place in God's redemptive activity among human beings. That's the context within which I work. Many years ago, a woman who remains a saint to my memory came up to me after an art history class and quietly but firmly pointed out ways in which I was using exclusivist sexist language and distortions in my comments about certain paintings. That was about 15 years ago. And that was before anybody had ever really written a document or an essay about the women's movement. So she was a prophet, way ahead of her time. But she was a very critical student. And her words stung, and I was bewildered, and I was disturbed, and I was very angry. But then I realized that she was making sense. And so I started to be more conscious of what I was talking about in my classes. And finally, I'm a slow learner. It took a long time, but last semester, I developed a seminar called Women in the Visual Arts. And I got 17 women who accepted me as a fellow student, trying to figure out, get to gain some perspectives. And we had a great time. We all, I think, developed into a strong community, and we discovered a lot of wonderful things. That woman who came to me and challenged me in my class wasn't a strident feminist. They hadn't come on the scene yet. She was way ahead of her time. And I hate these people. On my campus, I run and hide when I see one coming. And I know a lot of you people have had the same kind of experience. But polemics are necessary to make things start happening. We would all just sit here and doze if somebody didn't come up and shake us. And so the time has come for a careful analysis of our traditions and values. And in 1971, some of you read Art News magazine, I know you do. In 1971, Linda Nochlin asked the question in an Art News essay, why have there been no great women artists? And there was a long essay in that magazine that really struggled with the issue, but the answer was terrible. She said, the answer seems to be because women are incapable of greatness. And I'll come back to that in a moment and pursue that a little farther. Feminism, or the historical discovery of women, has had a broadening effect on art history. and has brought about an adjustment of historical perspective. In the 14th century, Petrarch walked through the streets of Rome, surveyed the ancient ruins, saw a witness to the greatness and splendor of Rome, and called it the Golden Age. This was the time before Rome adopted Christianity, and he called that period ancient history. And he compared it to the Christian era, which he called modern history, but he called modern history the Dark Ages. He saw a spiritual rebirth possible, and he became the cornerstone for a very new point of view in history. And it would become known as the Renaissance. And this is because a person took a critical look at his world. And he saw that period from the adoption of Christianity to the 14th century as a period dominated by superstition, ignorance, and barbaric activity. And it was a chaotic period. It isn't necessarily totally a dark age. That's a very negative point of view. But he asked a lot of hard questions about his own age and was the beginning of a new way of looking at things. And feminists have brought a new perspective to the kind of work that we do at our school, and that's at all of your schools. Feminists claim that the past 5,000 years has been a patriarchal era, an era which replaced a matriarchal, matrilineal, goddess-worshipping culture with a god-worshipping civilization. History has been an account of the deeds and institutions of men and the monuments erected to celebrate them. Clearer views of the controlling part that sexual assumptions and attitudes have played in creation, naming, and the history of art are apparent. Persistent low esteem for women and their activities has figured in all value judgments. And that's something that I'll try to demonstrate in some future sessions here. Art has always been thought of as a reliable barometer of a society's values and truths. Where your heart is, there will your treasures be also. Or you could say, where your art is, there will your treasures be also. Your art is a barometer of your values, what you hold dear. And it's becoming more and more apparent that the artistic truths that we honor from the past are actually the very narrow reflection of vested male interests. So back to Linda Nochlin. Why have there been no great women artists? And she says, because women are incapable of greatness. And they're incapable because of influences so pervasive that they're not even aware of them. A few women break away because they're unusually original or because they have some unusual gift of genius. But the majority of women are caught behind limited horizons without even knowing it. And the task is to recover women's cultural past, to reevaluate it, and to avoid the unconscious repetition of distorted and skewed traditions. And that, again, is some of the things I'll touch on this week. I'll try to show ways in which there have been some really horrible distortions of the role of women in the past. I'll talk about a late 16th century artist from Italy and some 17th century women in Holland, which really did support a great number of women artists. And I'd like to look at a very obscure and maybe to your eyes sort of pointless debate between a group called the Minimalists and a group called Process Artists in the 1970s. And we'll end up with the very minor and nice, but not very significant work of American quilt makers. That's the attitude that I came to that subject last semester with, and I ended up at the end of the class taught by some fellow students saying, wow, this was the most exciting thing that happened all semester. A study of our cultural past reveals a view of some apparently peaceful and harmonious matriarchal societies, such as the Minoan one on the island of Crete, which is a very exciting society in the Palace of Knossos. And it's a society which focused on a pregnant mother goddess who represented the continuity of life, the connection to the earth, and the triumph over death. And the Minoan culture ended maybe because of earthquakes, but maybe because of a shift towards an all-powerful male deity no longer associated with nature and life-giving processes. Athena, who is a product of a male society, is a female deity clothed in male military armor, and she was born from Zeus's head, and she's a product of the mind, not of nature. She's an invention of the mind. She has nothing to do with the earth. Susanna Torre is the editor of a book on American women architects, and she demonstrates how the architecture of social, political, economic, and judicial institutions became monumentalized into forms of enduring permanence. Women, who in earlier nomadic times had been primarily responsible for shelter, now sat by as inspiring muses and passively gratified onlookers, but never entered into creative competition with the men. The other night I talked about Hannah Arendt's book, The Human Condition. She divides human activity into two areas, labor and work. Labor is that human activity which corresponds to the processes of the human body. This activity is impermanent and private. It's concerned with the toil of survival, of feeding and clothing, of caring and nurturing and preserving. And when there is any art involved, it is a minor art. It is inferior. Labor is primarily in the feminine sphere, making dresses, making pajamas, making quilts, making curtains, making soup, making teepees. That's all women's work. Labor is contrasted with work, which is unnatural, not embedded in the species, disassociated from biological process, from life cycles, birth, maturity, death. It is permanent, it is private, it is public, and it's usually monumental. And if art is involved, it's a major art, it's a fine art, or it's called high art. Work belongs to men. Labor is involved with nature. Work is involved with culture. I hope that distinction is clear. An example of work is building a pyramid. An example of work is building the state capitol building, painting the Sistine ceiling, carving a statue. And that's quite different from making curtains, or little aprons, or potholders. Let's see, this is a book that meant a lot to me this year, The Gift, by Lewis Hyde. And it's subtitled Imagination and the Erotic Life of Property. And a lot of it is a kind of anthropological study of things like the potlatch tradition among the Northwest Coast Indians, the giving of gifts and getting gifts in return. But it goes on to talk about the arts. And there's two themes that run through the book. It's the concept of eros and logos. And he defines eros as that principle of attraction, union, participation, and involvement which binds gift givers reciprocally and mutually together in an erotic commerce. He talks about gift giving as a kind of erotic commerce. Eros is contrasted with logos, which is reason and logic, that principle which differentiates, separates, and distinguishes things from each other. Some of you have been to Rome, and you know Michelangelo's ceiling. And he paints this powerful image of God the Father with a furrowed brow, and with these powerful gestures, he separates light and dark, land and water, earth and the planets, male and female, hot and cold, near and far, big and small, now and then. All those things are separated because of his command. And this command comes, according to Michelangelo, from this thought, from the mind of God, the Creator. Labor, which we talked about earlier, which is connected to nature, springs from eros. It is women who are involved with eros. It is women who are gifted in social work. Social work is binding, connecting, relating. And it's motivated by desire, by love, by care. It is women who are gifted in soul work, in child care, in teaching. There is the inner life, the world of religious and spiritual values. There's arts and crafts. There's mutual aid. Women help each other. Men compete with each other. There's healing through sympathetic contact and touching. We all know about our mother's touch. We all know about our mother's rubbing our back and about the caresses that come from that person. It is women who build cohesive support groups, who provide for creative and educational idleness and the slow maturation of talent. And it would be fun to know about Dwayne's mother as we watch this display of slowly maturing talent. It's not still maturing. It seems to be there. And you'll hear it tonight. These are all in the feminine sphere. And if you think about it, none of these skills are marketable. Touching, supporting, caring, loving. You can't put a price on those kinds of activities. And when men are engaged in these activities, there was a man named Spiro Agnew, and he used to work for a man who used to work for this country named Richard Nixon. And he called teachers and nurses and ministers and all these kind of people effete. And I am so engaged. And I declare that I am no less a man because I listen to colors and fine-tuned shapes and pictorial relationships, and because I spend lots of hours contemplating the intrinsic qualities of cyclical nature. And I do a lot of that. I have a sunburned nose because of it. And I'm no less of a man because I did that yesterday. Lewis Hyde discusses gender and those activities and postures and speech patterns and attitudes and acquisitions which characterize a woman as feminine or a man as effeminate or a man as masculine or a woman as mannish. And sexuality is only one of the gender distinctions. And we're not really focusing on that aspect of this relationship. In this book, The Gift, Lewis Hyde tends to relate the masculine gender to the marketplace. There is a willingness to sacrifice attachment for advancement, affection for calculation. The man in the marketplace is self-possessed, not self-effacing, willing to shun the turkeys who were pals in college, willing to evict deadbeats from his apartment building, willing to put people out of work if a venture isn't paying, willing to close down an operation if some other property needs a shot of capital. Dumping friends is not disloyal. In a modern industrial nation, the ability to act without relationship is still a mark of the masculine gender. Boys become men by entering the marketplace and dealing in commodities. Women can do it too, but it will not enhance their femininity. Men are willing to sever relationships with nature, to cut up a mountain for the silver contained within it, to cut down the trees, to turn agricultural land into real estate, in short, to pave paradise and put up a parking lot. Men are in banking, law, management, sales, and war, among other things. Once we were exclusively a world of hunter-gatherers, our sacred focal point was the pregnant mother goddess who ensured continuity of life and the resurrection of nature from the death of winter. And we bury dead birds in the ground, and we bury seeds which die to be reborn like a phoenix. And the other night I talked about Maya Yin Ling's Vietnam Veterans Memorial. A very young Asian American woman dug a deep V-shaped gash into the ground and lined its walls with shiny black stone. Her name is Maya Ying Lin, and she was selected to design the Vietnam Memorial, a spatial temporal form which invites the viewer to come in and be a participant in this funereal and very feminine space, one of whose arms embrace the bereaved. One of its arms points towards the Washington Monument, an erect, white obelisk, detached from nature, autonomous, permanent, changeless, static. It stands as a physical fact, It is logos. It is masculine. It is not an axis mundi. The primitive man put a vertical post up to relate the earth to the heaven. The Indians let the smoke out of their teepee to create a vertical axis mundi, the axis of the earth. But I don't think we can claim that Washington's monument is our relationship between heaven and earth. It's a piece of obsolete, unrealistic historicism, detached from its original roots, imposed on the land as a symbol of American obsession with bigness and power. And it stands in strong opposition to Maya's quiet but dignified humility. And I'm not giving George Washington a fair shake there, but I think it's basically true. But we're a modern industrial world, and the pregnant mother goddess of a simpler lifestyle does not meet our complex needs of laser beams and stock markets and credit cards and all these other kinds of activities, which I would say are in the masculine sphere. Lewis Hyde equates the marketplace, as I've said, with masculinity. To be a man is to be successful in the secular, mercantile, entrepreneurial sphere of banking, law, and so on, where it may be necessary to sever, to cut off, rather than to unite and pull together. There was a very important building built in St. Louis. Some of you know that building. And it involves a collision of some very important values. The architect was Minoru Yamasaki, and he was trying to build the ideal high-density, low-cost mass housing development. And the name of that development was Pruitt-Igoe. And he had great confidence. He designed a perfectly clear, orderly, ideal space and imposed it on the complex multiplicity of a St. Louis black ghetto, and he created an inhumane monster divorced from biological life. And the American Institute of Architects gave it their award of excellence for the year as the best building that had ever been built and as the ideal solution to the problem of the ghetto, which was destroyed. This seedbed of filth, violence, and crime was sent crashing to the ground with tons of dynamite. Pruitt-Igoe was a total failure. It was oversimplified, overly controlled, unemotional, unremittingly serious, emphatically rational. It did not allow for any kind of participation, for multiplicity, for ambiguity, for change. An example, the lobbies had to look good. And they were elegantly designed. And there was a beautiful playground between these various high-rise buildings. And the women brought their children down to the playground. But unfortunately, little children are human, and they need to go to the bathroom. And the bathrooms were on the next floor, but the elevators didn't work very well. And so they had to use the staircases, but the little children couldn't get that far before they had to do something about their problem. And so little by little, this ideal lobby and these ideal staircases became bathrooms and cesspools. And they smelled bad, and they were filthy. And nobody wanted to go in there to clean it up. And that spread, and pretty soon, perfect forms and shapes were scratched. Graffiti appeared, and people had no respect for the space, and it was dangerous to live there. It was safer to live in the ghetto that they tore down. And the people moved out. They refused to live there. And so the city had no choice but to destroy it. Minoru Yamasaki arrogantly had some notion about ideal worlds, about how people ought to live, about some notions about perspective. But he had no sense of the reality of a black mother's life, whose husband probably disappeared, who was living on welfare, who had too many children, who was trapped in this building, and all of these elegant forms somehow had nothing to do with life as it was lived. Perhaps there needs to be women in the architectural profession, and they are starting to come. Would a woman have designed it differently, or would she have seen the project from a traditionally male point of view? Anne Morrow Lindbergh wrote in The Gift from the Sea, and she's writing about Plotinus, and she's writing about multiplicity, where we're confronted with a complex series of issues or problems that don't necessarily connect, where there's no simple, clear, central theme or issue. And she says, Plotinus was preaching the dangers of multiplicity back in the 3rd century. Yet the problem is particularly and essentially a woman's. Distraction is and always has been and probably always will be inherent in a woman's life. For to be a woman is to have interests and duties raying out in all directions from the central mother core like the spokes from the hub of the wheel. The pattern of our lives is essentially circular. We must be open to all points of the compass: husband, children, friends, home, community, jobs, professions, stretched out, exposed, sensitive like the spider's web to each breeze that blows, to each call that comes. Yamasaki at Pruitt-Igoe couldn't begin to grasp the complexity of the lives of women and children who were the principal inhabitants of his ideal world. Modern architecture is the reconciliation of things as they are with things as they ought to be. And that takes a lot of arrogance to decide how things ought to be. And there's a recent movement in modern architecture against that point of view called postmodernism. And it's the attempt to reconcile things as they are with things as they were. And I think there's something about the Holden theme for this year, Christ, the memory of our future, that involves that sense of rootedness in tradition, but not being a slave to the past. We get into the past in order to project ourselves into the future. And most modern art and most modern architecture short circuits the past. It's cutting it off. It's reacting against it. And it goes from the present somehow courageously off into the future with all this wisdom. But it's not really there. I'm coming to a conclusion. I really am. You're very patient. Jesus Christ was the focal point of the tension between Eros and Logos. He separated the kingdom from the marketplace, this entrepreneurial world of getting and spending, of making tough decisions, of turning your back on your friends if you have to make your business go. Jesus said, lend and expect nothing in return. He said, forgive your debts. He drove the money changers out of the temple. He told of the Good Samaritan and said, compassion, not blood, makes brothers and sisters. And in the modern marketplace, there's no room for compassion. There's no room for bleeding hearts. You'll lose your business. Our country will go down the drain if we all turn into bleeding hearts filled with compassion. And that's sort of the dilemma here. There's a book by a sculptor from California who's really interesting. His work is very subtle. It's hard to see. He works with veils that do strange things to spaces. And the name of his book is what I want you to remember. He says, the name of the book is Seeing is Forgetting the Name of That Which is Being Seen. Naming belongs to logos, that is, separating things. There is a black man. There is a German. She is a cook. He is a bachelor. This is Christian art. This is not Christian art. This is an apple. That is a carrot. There is an orangutan. Orangutans don't like carrots. But maybe that's going a little bit too deeply into the orangutan. The record for the Louvre Museum in Paris, which is a big museum, is, I think it's 42 minutes and 17 seconds. And that means seeing the winged victory and making it to the Mona Lisa and then getting back to the front door. And so you can say, I've been to the Louvre. I saw the Winged Victory. I saw Rubens' Medici series. I saw the Mona Lisa, Tintoretto's, et cetera, et cetera. And when you come out, you can write home and say, I saw all that. And Robert Irwin says that kind of activity belongs to logos. That is separating, distinguishing, defining, and certainly that is important. But seeing is participatory. To see something is to be compassionate. To see something is to enter into the life of something. To see something is to be a part of the intrinsic qualities of that thing. Every oak tree isn't the same. Every mountain ridge isn't the same. Every person isn't the same. It's more efficient to put everybody into a kind of category, a statistic, so many unemployed. But to enter into the life of that person is a quite different matter. So seeing belongs to eros, and eros is desire, and it's the desire for unity, for joining, for relationship, for community, for becoming a part of the secret life of something else, and to enter into the intrinsic life of it, and not to stay outside and simply be interested in its extrinsic values. How hard can he work? How much will he earn me? How much will he enhance my prestige if I hang around with him or her? Will I look good walking down the street with her on my arm? Those are all extrinsic kinds of relationships. Jesus in the house of Lazarus was looking ahead to his own crucifixion. A woman named Mary opened a costly jar of spikenard to pour on his head, and she didn't have names for her action. Maybe she didn't know titles like King and the Anointed One. She simply reached out in an all-embracing compulsive gesture and poured this expensive oil on Christ's head. Judas sat back grumbling with his male marketplace commodities mentality. The price of it, the gains possible through reinvestment. What about the poor? Jesus said, the rich and the poor you will always have with you as long as you can't see them, as long as you have no compassion, as long as you cannot feel my spirit among you. I'm getting far afield from my women's topic, but I think Mary and the costly jar of oil says a lot about a kind of, maybe it's a stereotype view about gender, but I, in terms of what I've been trying to talk about, I think she is a prime example of what it means to be in the feminine sphere of labor and of eros. Barbara Rossing told me the other day that I'm a nifty 80s man because I came here to talk about women. It's all courant to talk about women. It's fashionable. And the woman who challenged me about 15 years ago was way ahead of her time. And maybe, I wish I could have talked about women when I was here at Holden Village in 1969. Would have been fun to have had the perspective that would allow me to go to art history and see it quite differently. And I'm really excited about my paracollege for forcing me, in a way, to come to grips with this topic and to develop a whole course on the subject. And I'm quite disturbed that there are no men taking these classes. No men study women's studies. And actually, that's what we're talking, who we're supposed to be talking to. It's even more disturbing that a lot of women won't go near these courses. They won't have anything to do with the movement. And I, maybe it takes time, but I found it was a real privilege to be intimately involved with 17 very wonderful women. We got very intimate. We talked about very private and personal things. And I think some women were launched out of some real difficulties because of that course. And I mentioned before that I found I'm first of all a teacher and I work with students, and very often I find out a lot about them. And I don't know how to be a counselor, but sometimes I have a hunch that if some of these women got involved with some really interesting women artists and architects and sculptors and designers, that they might find out something about themselves that would give them a lot of courage to accept themselves as they are, or to develop some very unique perspectives about things as they are. And I hope that I can give you a little glimpse of that during some future sessions, because I find in the history of art, there are a lot of strong genius figures, very original artists, but they all tend to treat everything the way the subject matter has always been treated. But a woman comes along and she says, this is not necessarily so. And she takes a particularly different point of view about some very traditional thing. She's able to leap out of the kind of stranglehold of the way things have always been done. And it's simply because she dares to be herself. She dares to be this woman. And she dares to say, there are other points of view. And here I'm just talking about abstract things. And we'll have to get some works of art on the screen tomorrow to get more specific. But I have a hard time anymore talking about inferior and superior in terms of the arts and in terms of everything. I go back to the book of Colossians. I'm interested in not in things that are better than other things or weaker than other things. I'm interested in things that come together. I'm interested in brothers and sisters with faces turned towards the fullness of God. That's the image that I come to those kinds of subjects with. And that's the end of my scribbling, because it was 5 minutes to four and I had to run down here. It's 4:49. Does anybody have the energy to make one statement or one comment or dismiss all this? Or maybe it's all very obvious to you. I don't mean to be unusually humble, but I am a beginning student in this area. I knew that there was a difference between men and women, but I guess I didn't really think much about it. And that's sort of what I'm doing now. Yes?
Are there a lot of women teaching in the art departments in the colleges now?
Not enough.
It's still hard to break through.
Let's see. We have... We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We have 5 full-time men, 1 full-time woman, and 2 half-time women. So we're behind. I think that's right. My school is working hard on it, and there are some tremendous women in the faculty now. I was a department chairman, and I realized that I really was biased against the woman in our department, and that affected her in terms of her salary and promotion, and I really didn't think she was doing her job. I think if I had to do that today, and I'm really sorry about this, I think she was terrific. I remember as a painting teacher telling women, we don't paint that kind of stuff. They bring these perfume bottles and lipsticks and earrings and beads and ribbons. I said, we don't do that kind of stuff in the art department. I didn't know the word wimpy, but that's exactly what I was implying. Men draw bricks and stones and steel beams, and we use right angles, and we're strong and forceful and dynamic. We don't use pink, yellow, and lavender. I mean, and if they did that, they got a C-. And there's a woman I brought along, I don't know if I'll talk about her, but her name is Audrey Fleck, and she makes monumental paintings about lipstick and perfume bottles and earrings and pins, and they're powerful. And when I finally discovered Audrey Fleck, I went home with a red face. And I said, oh, what have I done to all these women? So I think as I reflect back on some of my attitudes, I always thought I was really perfect, but I'm starting to wonder.
Has your own painting changed?
Yes, I don't know how to say this very quickly, but I'm making distinctions between masculine and feminine. I did say that I'm involved in what I would call the feminine sphere, and I don't think that detracts from my gender. And there are certainly women involved in the masculine sphere, and it doesn't detract from their gender. And so it is a physical thing, but it's also an attitude, and it's an area of activity. And I can't remember how that all started. Oh yes, has my painting changed? Yes, I think it has. I think it's more organic, more related to natural forms, more involved with the restlessness of nature and all these things. And it used to be about barn timbers and bridge structures, and which are nice things also. You were?
She asked about instructors. I was wondering about over the last, say, 20 years or 30 years in art classes in college, haven't women been a higher proportion of the students in art courses? And how do you put that in?
Art is a women's activity, and it's right. It's sissy to be in art. Right. I mean, you got to be in economics and football. It's been an inferior activity, and when students in high school aren't very good, you send them to the art department. And they'll take care of them. They'll keep them busy and give them clay to play with them. But I think that's changed. We had 33 seniors this year, and I think we had a majority of men. And they're good students, they're bright, they're multi-majors, economics and art, computer science and art, history and art.
What I'm asking is if this has been the case over the years, why did this keep on, why didn't this change sooner? If women were the ones who were in art, was it?
I think the people that wrote about it, well, let's see. I think it goes back to the dealers.
Yeah.
The dealers wouldn't show women's paintings. And if you're not shown, you don't get famous, and then you don't get into the history book. And there are a lot of women who changed their names. Rosa Bonheur passed herself off as a woman, as a man. Grace Hardigan is a really gutsy abstract painter, and she signed her paintings G. Hardigan and let the dealer assume it was George or somebody. In the first major exhibit in the late 40s of the abstract expressionist painters, Willem de Kooning and Jackson Pollock, the Dripper, wanted Joan Mitchell to have the place of honor in that exhibit, and the dealer, I think it was Leo Castelli, he would not allow her into the show. He said, no one wants to buy a painting by a woman. So she's, let's see, and Pollock's wife, Lee Krasner, was excluded from the exhibits, from the marketplace, and so she isn't in the books, and she's just now being recognized as a very important artist. There is a book called Art and Sexual Politics that goes into this a great deal. And I know that women are being admitted into the architectural schools, and that might, I mean, nobody has come up with the solution to high density, low cost housing, and it's very possible that some woman will finally make the building. They've all been disasters. It's partly because the people who live in them don't have the energy to work on community, or they don't have an ideological center or something, but it also is partly the fault of the building itself. And if Ann Morrow Lindbergh could design the building, maybe you'd never be able to find the front door. It would be this big labyrinth kind of form with movable walls, and the roof could go disappear on a nice day. And I don't know. But anyway, I'm running at the mouth.
But it would have bathrooms next to the play area.
Probably, yeah. And the kitchen wouldn't be stuck off in some back corner someplace.
Yeah.
It would be someplace where there's a window, it would have relationship to the family, to the living room.
Notice where Frank Lloyd Wright put the kitchens.
Yeah, he put it.
No windows.
Well, it was in the next county because it made bad odors and. And it was messy. Not always, but usually Frank Lloyd Wright stuck the kitchen. Someplace where he thought women's place was, barefoot and pregnant out there where you couldn't see you. Yes.
No.
Do you think these are inborn aggressor relationships which carries from the home into business, between business and labor and men and women and all the way through our...
I was trying to say something about that last week, the first day, and I should call on my psychology buddy here, Jackie. But I was trying to say something about how women are socialized to be looked at. Women are socialized to be a vision or a sight. Their appearances. Men are socialized to look at women. Men are socialized to act, to do things. Women are socialized to be done too. It's sort of instinct. Right? Well, it is an instinct. Can't be. It just doesn't seem right.
I say it's sort of inborn, is that?
I don't know if it's inborn. I think it's values and wiring diagrams that we've developed. When you look, if you've ever gone to Crete and you go to the palace at Knossos, you see these murals and you get an idea about a society in which men and women are equal. And they're all engaged in athletic contests, and they're all engaged with the ocean, with water, with nature, with growing things, and they're together. Their leader happens to be a mother rather than a father. And they existed for hundreds of years as a very prosperous, very peaceful kind of community. And we don't know exactly why that culture ended. But I think when you get a competitive, male-dominated sort of value system with the Romans and the Greeks and all of that, where women were, Greek women were just tragically nothing. They were inferior males. They're there and they're sometimes celebrated, but when you look closely, they are really nothing. There's that attitude in the Christian tradition with this dirty woman named Eve who caused all kinds of problems. It's just on and on and on. It's kind of built into.
Even the way Paul treated women in.
Yeah.
The Bible, I'm resentful of that.
Yeah, but he certainly couldn't really rise above his culture.
Jesus did.
Yes, yeah. Jesus is an exception. Jesus is Eros. Desire, love, care. Eros is also physical. And it's erotic.
But can you explain Paul then, who is supposedly the Word of God also?
I'm not skillful enough to...
Because he's a human. He was human and Jesus was God on earth.
Maybe that's the answer.
He was the same, but
he's
still
part
human.
Of his society and his culture. Let's see.
He's Greek educated too.
I don't feel real comfortable talking about the problem of the literal nature of the Bible. I know that to be a Lutheran, you have to get a... I mentioned the other day to you, to be a Lutheran and to go to heaven means you have to get at least a B+ in a religion class. And you have to be able to carry a tomb. If you can't do either of those, you're condemned forever. And I only got a C in religion, and I didn't do very well on the test about the inerrancy of the scriptures. I'm ducking out here. We'll ask Elmer Witt to talk about that. Yes?
One of our friends in Duluth does great monumental, a woman artist, does great monumental things of candy.
Yes. What's her name?
Kay Kurt.
Yes, that's true.
And that's...
Yeah.
I remember when I first met her and she talked about what she did, it was real easy to kind of minimize it. And she's she's very well respected.
I think she's doing both. She's making big, strong public statements about silly little intimate private things that touch children. Yes?
A couple of things. One is that, as I understand my recent readings in psychology and the differences between men and women, and is that there's a book Lillian Rubin's written, one called Intimate Strangers, and as I read that, she's saying that there is kind of a real basic difference, but it's because it is because of the way we're raised, and as I'm starting to understand it, it's because women are the ones that do the raising of the children in this society, both men and women, or boys and girls. Mm-hmm. And so that, you know, whether there's an intrinsic difference, you know, that's, as I understand it, that's real up in the air question right now. That's a real, it's not agreed upon by people, as I understand it now.
Does it?
Another woman named Carol Gilligan wrote a book called In a Different Voice, and she makes the statement and the thesis in there that women basically make moral decisions on a totally different basis than men do. Men do it on general and some kind of absolute standard. You know, there is an absolute right moral, da 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 da, thus maybe Paul in the Bible. Whereas women take everything in context, you know. Context is almost everything.
Yeah.
So, you know, how that influences art. One example is I saw a movie recently called The Dinner Party, which was about Judy Chicago, who was a woman artist who essentially gathered this community together and did this community project of honoring 39 out of some 3,000 names of women who've been important in the history of women in the world. And these 39 women, they designed these place settings and these beautiful hand embroidered, I don't know what you call them, things that drape over the table.
Tablecloths.
Yeah.
Place settings.
Yeah, place settings. They were big, you know, they were big. And they exhibited in San Francisco at the Museum of Art, and it had like the biggest opening day crowd, or, you know, set a big record. And after the exhibit, no other museum in the country would take it, and they had to put it into storage. And she was, you know, the only time in the movie that she was in tears was at the very end when they were talking about the fact that this was going to have to go into storage. And she was saying, look it, you know, here we are. We've done it in a community process that is more woman-oriented, you know, whatever that may be, than male-type hierarchical. And here we've designed this. People like it, but nobody will take it. You know, so it's the brokers, you know. And
that's, it's a very controversial work. The imagery is startling and disturbing. The imagery is vaginal, and it's 39 place settings of vaginal imagery, and it's not in every museum that's going to bring that to town and promote it.
But look how many. I mean, the Washington Monument, is that a phallic image or what?
Well, it could be, but it's a little more subtle. Well. From my point of view.
Yeah.
I didn't want to call it that. I just called it a physical fact.